This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 145, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. You can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 120 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to two guests. The first is Adam Frank, and we'll be talking about his book, The Little Book of Aliens. The second guest is Betsy Lewis, and we'll be talking about her book, Abducted, True Stories of Humans Kidnapped by Aliens. Adam is the Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Rochester. For many years, Adam was a leading expert on the final stages of evolution for stars like the Sun. His current work focuses on life in the universe, the search for technosignatures of other exo-civilizations. Adam has appeared on The Joe Rogan Show, Pharrell Williams' I Am Other podcast, Coast to Coast, and other radio shows. He has also appeared on a variety of national and international science documentaries, such as Alien Worlds, Mars, and The Universe. Adam has received a number of awards, including the Carl Sagan Medal for Excellence in Public Communication by the American Astronomical Society. Hi, Adam. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Real pleasure, Simon.
We're going to be talking about your book. It's called The Little Book of Aliens, and it's a fascinating book. But first of all, I wanted to ask you, as far as UFOs go, would you say you're agnostic?
I am agnostic in the sense of, you know, one has to do the science to answer any questions. But I would certainly say, based on the data that's out there, there is no data that would lead someone like myself, who studies this, who studies the possibilities of life in the universe professionally, to conclude that there's anything happening in the skies that has anything to do with non-human technology.
So you say in the book that in 2019, you and a group of colleagues were awarded NASA's first grant to study exoplanet technosignatures. So can you give us a brief overview of what that means?
Yes. So, you know, from the astronomer's point of view, the search for life in the universe is about whether it's, you know, smart life, meaning intelligent life, or dumb life, meaning biospheres, meaning, you know, just the microbial life or whatever other forms it takes, is something that, you know, astronomers have been interested in for a very long time, but we haven't been able to do much with it because we didn't have the equipment. We didn't have the technology that to do anything with it. So we can talk about SETI. We can go back to the 1960s, you know, and talk about that, but I won't go into that right now. But so what the truly extraordinary thing, the real game changer that happened in this field was in the 1990s when we first discovered planets orbiting other stars. We did not know up until that time whether or not planets were really rare. Our solar system could have been a freak, you know, a really unusual occurrence. And starting in the 1990s, we started discovering planets, and we soon discovered so many of them that we realized that pretty much every star in the sky has planets. Those are what we call exoplanets. And our technology is now becoming good enough that we can look at them in enough detail to look for signatures of life on those planets. Even though we're not going to visit them anytime soon, we can actually detect, by observing their atmospheres, by observing the reflected light off of their surface, signatures of the possibility of a biosphere, right? A biosphere is the collection of life on a planet. So biosignatures, the signatures of a biosphere on an exoplanet, is now has been a major emphasis in astronomy for the last, say, 15 years. People really pushing the technology, pushing the theory. And we're in a position where we can begin to look for biosignatures. Now, technosignatures would be the technological equivalent of a biosignature. But because of the history of particularly UFOs, because of, you know, a lot of the wackiness that has happened with UFOs and UFO culture, NASA really got burned by Congress over the years and really didn't want to do anything that sounded like they were doing SETI, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So NASA was really avoiding anything that would be associated with intelligence, i.e. a techno signature. And our grant was the first time, NASA awarded funding in quite a long time to do a study that was going to be associated with the possibility of technospheres, of an intelligent, technological, industrial, however you want to put it, civilization on another, on exoplanet. So that's sort of the background to understand what it, why that grant was so important. And so for since 2019, our group has been really pushing the frontiers of at least understanding what techno signatures could look like. We're not looking yet. We're just sort of doing the studies, the theoretical studies, to understand what kind of things might you see across 50 light years that would tell you that there's a technological civilization on an exoplanet. Very exciting.
So how's it going? Have you studied lots of planets, or have you only done like the first 10? How long does it take to do the study on one planet?
Well, this is a long game, and we're not looking at all yet. We're not doing any observations yet. When you begin in a science, the first thing you have to do is you have to try to systematize your thinking about the subject and then begin to figure out which approaches are going to be the most fertile, right? So the history of SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is such that there was never any funding for it. It was not a secure thing for a young scientist to go into. And so if you look at the history from 1960 on, it was basically a lot of older professors sort of throwing out an idea here or there, like, oh, maybe we should look at neutrinos. Maybe aliens are using neutrinos to signal each other. Or, we should be doing lasers, you know, one after the other. The ideas never got followed up on. And what I mean by that, no one ever took that first idea and then did the next study and really probed it to see whether this was a good idea or a waste of time. So our job over the last 6 years, we haven't looked at anything. We haven't been given telescope time to do anything yet. Our job has been to sort through the ideas, propose new ideas, and then do the hardcore theoretical work to understand whether that proposed techno signature is a good one or is not even going to play out. So do you want me to give you an example?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so one of the things we thought about early on, or that actually some other people had thought about, was the possibility of what we might call industrial pollution, air pollution, right? Or things, chemical compounds in an atmosphere of a planet that could only be produced by industry. And so a good example, an Earth example of this, is chlorofluorocarbon, CFCs. So chlorofluorocarbons are a type of compound, a molecule, that we on Earth have produced through industry. And we've used them in air conditioning, and we've used them as propellants in spray cans. And these are famous because we use them so much, and so much of CFC, so many, you know, megatons of CFC ended up in the atmosphere that they were actually destroying the ozone layer, right? So that's kind of why CFCs are famous. And they're actually in the Montreal protocols in 86, they actually put limits on the CFCs, started to phase them out so that, you know, we wouldn't damage the ozone. So that's the Earth story. But there's many reasons why someone might put CFCs into the atmosphere on purpose. For example, if you're trying to terraform a planet, chlorofluorocarbons are great greenhouse gases. And if you wanted to warm up Mars, for example, you could pump huge amounts of CFCs into an atmosphere. So CFCs will not be produced by nature. They will only be produced by a technological civilization and put in the atmosphere either by mistake or on purpose. But either way, they can only be produced by technology. What we showed was, we did a study where we created climate models where we put a lot of CFCs into an Earth-like planet. We let the atmosphere settle down. That we then observed, you know, theoretically using a simulation, we observed that planet from a distance of like 10 or 40 light years. We put the planet around different kinds of stars, and we asked, could we detect that planet using, say, the James Webb Space Telescope or the next generation of space telescopes coming up? And what we found, the answer was yes. Actually, without a ridiculous amount of telescope time, you could detect chlorofluorocarbons in the atmosphere of an alien world from 40 light years away. So what we showed was is that chlorofluorocarbons are a good candidate technosig. So how does that sound?
Oh, it sounds great. Something that you talk about in the book is that you explain just how big space is. And it's mind-blowing. And a planet 40 light years away, you think it's that far away. And also it's next to a star. To be able to work out if there are CFCs in the atmosphere, can you really trust the data?
Yes. Yes. And that's really, you know, where I want people to understand. One of the reasons I wrote this book, I want people to understand what it takes to make a claim, you know, an extraordinary claim, like I have found life in the universe, and the data, the gathering of the data, the analysis of the data, how much work, you know, you have to put in to be able to make that claim and have confidence in the claim. So we scientists are really mean to each other when it comes to our data and our claims. Like if I wanted to go in front of my scientist friends and make the claim that like, oh, we have looked at, you know, some near star 40 light years away and we found evidence of chlorofluorocarbons, I would expect to have my butt handed to me, right? People are going to try to shred, and they should. They're going to try and shred everything I've done in making that claim. They're going to want to look at the theoretical analysis I did. They're going to want to look at how I gathered the data, how I used the telescope, how I analyzed the data, looking for any way in which they can break the chain that leads from the data to the claim, right? As they should. That is how science works. And that is why your cell phone works, right? We're developing. I mean, we're still probably maybe 10 years, 20, 30 years away from really, really being able to wholesale, to really get a lot of observations. But we finally have the capacities to do this. So the answer is yes. I think, you know, as the decades roll on, we're going to start getting data that we are going to have confidence in, one way or the other, that we're either finding life in the universe or being able to put real limits on not finding life in the universe. The important thing is, after millennia of yelling at each other about aliens, right? People have been arguing about life in the universe since the Greeks. We are finally going to have scientific data that we can have confidence in that's going to tell us something one way or the other about the question.
So with that whole kind of scientific attitude, and like you say, they try and tear apart what you've got, what would be needed to do a real scientific study on UFOs? I suppose you'd have to have a flying saucer to dismantle.
That would be a good thing. But even, you know, as I try in the book, I tried to show what a real scientific investigation of UFOs would look like. And in some sense, it wouldn't look that different from what we're doing when we're looking at planets, right? So, having the UFO in hand is the thing you want, of course. But even if we had arrays of telescopes. So in the book, I talked about, in order to have a scientific study of UFOs, what you'd need to do is you need to be able to look up, look down, and look all around, which sounds pretty stupid. But the idea there was, you know, one thing you could try and do is try by looking up. I mean, you could set out an array of upward looking detectors, right? Which is, people already doing this for meteors. There's already automated cameras or telescopes that look upwards, wide angle, and they have all kinds of detectors on them. Detectors meaning something that can pick up light, pick up sound, particles, but that is constantly looking. And when an event happens, suddenly, you know, a trigger goes off and all of these things suddenly look up. So that's one way. That's the looking up. The other way you can do it is by looking down from space. We have lots of satellites. You could have, and this is what the NASA UAP panel was talking about. Can we use NASA satellites to look down and try and track things that are happening? That's another way. And then the third way is the looking all around, which is, you know, we have a lot of pilots in the sky. And I'm all for pilots being able to, you know, report whatever they see without fear of being laughed at, right? It's the only way you're going to gain data. And so you can imagine maybe they're, you know, we add a couple of sensors onto commercial planes as well as military planes, such that, you know, if somebody sees something, they can hit a button and the sensors begin to start recording data. So that's what I mean about looking up, looking down, and looking all around. But the important thing about this is the only way you can really trust what's going on is you got to have your own instrument, right? So all those Navy, not all, right? There's really only those three Navy videos that get trotted out over and over again. The problem with those was that, you know, what was this camera? Like, where, when were the cameras that are being used, you know, that recorded, when was the last time they were serviced? What kind of software updates did they have? Where were they built? You know, in order to do a scientific investigation, you have to know everything about your instrument. Like with the James Webb Space Telescope, if I'm going to use it, I need to know how it responds at short wavelength. I need to know how it responds at long wavelengths. I mean, in detail, I have to know how it responds if the temperature goes up 5 degrees or if the temperature goes down 5 degrees. The only way I can trust the data. And the problem with most UFO stuff is that, you know, what we get are blurry photographs, endless blurry photographs, personal accounts, which again, and with personal accounts, again, I would never tell somebody they didn't see what they saw because I wasn't there. But we can't use personal accounts to make the leap to, oh my God, there's aliens. You know, and also here's the thing about personal accounts is that every prosecutor and cop will tell you, personal testimony is the worst. It is full of problems. When people get excited, and also here's actually a very important thing about personal accounts is that memory is not a record, right? A memory is not a photograph. All kinds of things can affect memory afterwards in good faith. It's not like anybody's lying. It's just that, you can do studies where you have people look at things, you know, watch events, have something happen during the event, and you'll get five different, if you have five different people, you can get five different accounts of what happened. So you just can't, personal accounts really are not useful for doing the kind of science to try and answer this most important question. So yeah, it really comes down to you're going to have to build your own instruments and, and have control over them and put them out in a rational search strategy, a rational analysis strategy, which I talk about in the book. That's the only way you're ever going to answer the question about UAPs.
So do you think that personal accounts or maybe even multiple witness accounts of UFOs, I don't know, they can just be disregarded? We can just ignore them, even though we have 10,000 or 20,000 of them? We could just say, sorry, we can't take this at all. We just have to ignore you.
Well, let's look at the history of when people have tried to look in detail at these accounts, right? So, just recently the AAVSO, I can never remember all of the acronyms, but the U.S. government went through. They had about 800 reports that they looked at, and what they found was about 95 to 96% of them were actually all explainable, and this number about 96%. That 96% of the account of UFO sightings actually have, reasonable explanations goes all the way back through all of the reports. And in the book, I go through all of the reports. I talk about the government reports and their problems and the problems with them, but also, generally what was found. And that number, about 96%, is pretty common. So actually, all of these personal accounts, if you actually go look at them and you do the interviews and then you try and figure out time of day, and what other meteorological phenomena was happening? And were there balloons? Were there planes? Only 5 to 4% of those things actually survive as being like, oh, we don't know what that was. So based on that, including the most recent work done by, credible people credibly trying to understand these things, it turns out that the sky is not full of unexplained phenomena. There are a few that defy explanation, but it's really a minority. Most of these things can be explained.
And you were talking about the Pentagon videos that were released. And I talked to Matt Roberts, who was the intelligence officer on the USS Roosevelt. And he told me that the videos they released were a much lower resolution than the ones they have. I said, why release much lower resolution videos? He says, we don't want our enemies to know our capabilities, and we don't want them to know how good our cameras are on an aircraft. And so I think if we had the proper videos, we might get a much better idea of what was filmed there. I wonder if, some people will pick apart all the videos and find problems with it. And I think you talk about a study where they looked at it and they thought when the UFO looked like it was just a few feet above the sea, it could have been at 30,000 feet and doing 40 miles an hour.
Right. Right.
But if it's seen at a few feet above the sea by the pilots as well as the video, then that saying it's at 30,000 feet doesn't really stand, does it?
But it wasn't. So though, but see, that's the problem with those, because again, it's those three videos that get, you know, sliced and diced and shown over and over, as if though the account of the pilots seeing the Tic Tac right above the water is not the video. They're not talking about the same thing of the video that you saw with that the analysis from the data on the screen itself showed that it was at 30,000 feet and moving at 40 miles an hour, right? So that's the problem, is we conflate the stories of, you know, the pilots saw something with the videos, and often those videos are not the same event, right? And see, that's the problem with often those videos. There's lots of, they get used over and over again, and they conflated in the stories I've talked with some of the pilots, and again, I think it's great that the pilots, good that the pilots, and one of the things I really like about the pilots is the pilots are like, they're not saying it's aliens. They're just like, look, man, I saw this. I don't understand what it was. Could somebody please work on it? And I think that's like the absolute right agnostic attitude to have. But yeah, like that video that where they, you know, it was from the data on the camera. It's, you know, on the recording itself that they got that. And that was not the same event where and I've forgotten the names, I'm sorry, where they saw the Tic Tac, you know, where the pilots were like, oh my God, I saw it right above the water.
All right. Well, I want to change the subject because there's another bunch of things I want to ask you about that you talk about in the book. So the first thing is the Drake equation. And you say, what is the Drake equation? Why does it matter so much? So how did Drake work it out?
Yeah, the great thing about the Drake equation, which is, you know, whether you're interested in UFOs, UAPs, or, you know, or the what I'll call the scientific search, which is, you know, using telescopes, what the kind of work that my colleagues and I do, is that it all comes from Drake in a way. Drake was the first one to formalize, which is really important. In science, you cannot make progress unless you know what question you're asking, like explicitly. And Drake was the first one to formalize the question about life in the universe. And the story is that Drake, Frank Drake, very brave guy, was the first person to do a astrobiology experiment at all. Any kind of, if you're interested in life in the universe, Drake did. He was the first scientist to ever come up with a way to ask the question, how can I experimentally test whether or not there's life in the universe? And so what he did, of course, was he used a radio telescope. They were new in those days. This is like 1960, relatively new. And he looked at two stars for signals, for any kind of anomalous, non-natural signal from these two stars. And that was pretty radical and revolutionary. Now, of course, he was looking for intelligent life. This was the beginning of SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. But it still was the first astrobiological experiment. Like we didn't have a way in those days to look for non-intelligent life, meaning biospheres, forests, microbes. So it was still, no matter what, the first astrobiological experiment. And he kind of afterwards, he sort of expected everybody, you know, he's looking over his shoulder to see who was laughing at him. And instead, he got a call from the government asking him to host a meeting on interstellar communication. Whoa. So he put together this meeting. No meeting like this had ever happened before in the history of science. He invited, there were like 8 or 9 people who were invited, including a young Carl Sagan. And the night before the meeting, he has to come up with an agenda, right? What exactly are they going to talk about for 3 days if they're trying to talk about interstellar communications? And the Drake equation was actually the agenda. What the Drake equation is it first of all sets the problem, which is how many civilizations are there out there in the galaxy that we could communicate with? That's the question, right? And then it's like, well, okay, let me break that question up into a bunch of sub-questions whose answer, if I multiply all of the answers to the sub-questions, will give me the answer to the question I'm interested in, which is how many intelligent civilizations there are out there. So the Drake equation is an equation where the answer is N, the total number of civilizations. And then he broke it up into 7 sub-problems. The first one is the number of, the rate of formation of stars, then the fraction of those stars that have planets, and then the number of planets that are in what we call the habitable zone where life could form, then the fraction of those planets where life forms, and then the fraction of that life that goes on to become intelligent, then the fraction of those intelligences that develop civilizations, and then finally you multiply it all times the lifetime, how long the civilization lasts, and you multiply all those terms together and you'll get the answer n to how many civilizations there are. And so each one of those terms becomes a problem you can work on separately in order to answer the equation. So basically, Drake's agenda for the meeting became the agenda for the astrobiological community. And we've been like knocking off terms in the Drake equation one by one. Like when Drake wrote down the equation, there was only one term that was answered. Now we have three terms that are answered. So it's pretty exciting. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I've heard of these things because I read too much science fiction. The next one is the Fermi paradox, which I think was proposed in 1950. So yes. Do you think the Fermi paradox might be out of date, or it just needs a little bit of updating?
No. I think the Fermi, it's interesting. The Fermi paradox has shaped a lot of how people have thought about life, especially intelligent life in the universe. And it's funny because it really wasn't proposed in 1950. It's that Enrico Fermi, the Enrico Fermi kind of in a conversation with friends made the statement that then almost 25 years later got codified into the so-called paradox. So Fermi, basically the Fermi paradox, Enrico Fermi and his friends were going to lunch at Los Alamos, and they were talking about a cartoon in the New Yorker magazine, because they're out in Los Alamos, but they're all getting the New Yorker. And it was a cartoon that showed that there was a lot of trash cans in New York were disappearing. And the cartoon showed UFOs landing and taking the trash can. So this was 1950, but already, the UFO craze had already started. So they're talking about this cartoon and they're kind of laughing. And then being physicists, they started talking about interstellar travel and sort of work, working out how long would it take, yada, yada. And then a half an hour later over lunch, the conversation moves on. Half an hour later over lunch, Fermi blurts out in his typical Fermi way, well, where is everybody? Right. And what he'd done is he'd suddenly done the calculation in his head, and he realized that if space traveling civilizations were common, even if they didn't have warp drives or anything, even if they were moving at a fraction of the speed of light. And of course, we know right now that there's no way to go faster than the speed of light. Like that's right now, unless some other physics changes, that's a hard limit. But he'd worked out that it would take about, maybe 500,000 years to cross the galaxy, right? Which seems like a long time, but compared to the age of the galaxy, it's very short. So the idea would be that, like, if there were space traveling civilizations, they would have hopped, they should have made it to every planet in the galaxy by now. So why aren't they here on Earth right now, announcing themselves to the president? So that's what, out of that, then later on in 1975, a guy named Hart wrote a paper where he used the fact that no one's here. Okay, obviously he's saying that UFOs are not aliens, to say like, well, if there were intelligent civilizations, they should already be here. We don't see them here. Therefore, there are no intelligent civilizations, right? That is what is meant by the Fermi paradox. Like, there should be intelligent civilizations. Why not? We don't see any here. So therefore, they don't exist. So that paradox, I mean, people have been arguing about this for years. There's even a book called 77 Solutions to the Fermi Paradox. But I'm here to tell you today that there is no Fermi Paradox, right? That there really, this is something that is actually a giant mistake in our thinking. And we're actually working on a paper about this right now. And I'll tell you why, what I mean by this. So first of all, people, when they talk about the Fermi Paradox, there's actually two different paradoxes or versions of it that they're kind of misconstruing. One is what Fermi meant. Why aren't they here right now? Like, why haven't they landed on, the White House lawn and announced themselves? The other one, people will say like, oh, look, since Frank Drake, we've been looking at the night sky and we haven't seen any messages or any alien signals. Therefore, aliens don't exist. And that sometimes this is called the great silence. So the first one I'll call the direct Fermi paradox. The second one is the indirect, right? We're looking using radio telescopes and we haven't seen anything. The second one is entirely wrong because we haven't looked, right? People have this idea that every night astronomers are taking their radio telescopes, like Jodie Foster in Contact, and pointing it at the night sky and, looking for signals. But the fact is, there's, you know, it takes a lot of money to have a telescope. You have to get permission to use it. And SETI was never well-funded. SETI has been living on fumes since day one. And there's never been any searches. They're not really, not the kind of searches you need to do. A friend of mine, Jason Wright, and his colleagues, they took all the SETI searches that have ever been done and they added them all up. And they said, okay, how much of the night sky have we actually looked at? And if we think of the night sky and the stars and all the radio frequencies that we have to look at as the ocean, and we're looking, and the aliens are fish, how much of the ocean, of Earth's oceans, let's use that analogy, have we searched for, or searched? And it turns out it's a hot tub, right? So out of the Earth's entire oceans, we've basically looked at a hot tub's worth of water. We haven't found any fish. And so, you know, does that mean we're like, well, there's no fish in the ocean? That would be pretty stupid, right? So there is no indirect Fermi paradox because there's never been the funding to do the astrobiological experiments to look. Now, finally, we're starting to finally get that funding. So, you know, that may change in the next, you know, 50, 60 years. But as of right now, there's no indirect Fermi paradox because no one looked. As for the direct Fermi paradox, there are so many ways around it. There's so many holes in that argument that it just doesn't have much force, right? I can give you like 10 different possible solutions to why there's no one here right now. Now, of course, if you're into UFOs, you think people are here right now, but let's put that in a box for a second. In that case, you're like, there is no Fermi paradox, but let's say you think there are not aliens here. There are so many different explanations for why we don't observe aliens on Earth now that it's not a very strong, nobody should be really worried about this as a paradox. It's not a paradox.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called The Little Book of Aliens. People can get that on Amazon, can't they? Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Simon. You have a great day.
So next I'm talking to Betsy Lewis about her book, Abducted: True Stories of Humans Kidnapped by Aliens. For the past 40 years, Betsy has investigated alien stories, UFO sightings, ancient petroglyphs in the Northwest, and conducted field investigations into the bizarre cattle mutilations throughout the Northwest. She has authored 21 non-fiction paranormal books and 3 children's books. She is the host of Stargate Radio. In 2013, Betsy was a keynote speaker at the Alamo UFO Conference and a keynote speaker at the 2018 Stargate to the Cosmos Conference. Hi, Betsy. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Simon. I'm excited to talk to someone from the UK today.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Abducted: True Stories of Humans Kidnapped by Aliens. There's all sorts of stories in there, all sorts of people and analysis, but you've had your own encounters, haven't you? Could you tell us, how did it start for you?
Well, I was about 6 months old, and I was with my parents. We were on a little road trip the weekend, I think maybe a little bit longer than that, to visit family from northwestern Idaho to southern Idaho. And this was 1950. I'm giving away my age. They were traveling on a road. It was rural out there, a few ranches out there. It was dark, very dark, when they went through an area called New Meadows. And they hadn't seen a car for miles. Suddenly, out of nowhere, they hear this horrendous noise, and it began shaking the car. And their only thought was, a plane is going to crash, and it's going to crash on them. My mom described it. My father didn't have a lot of memories of it later in life, but my mom claimed that it was like somebody turned on a faucet and off, and it suddenly stopped. And they got out of the car. My dad had pulled over. They got out of the car. There was nothing in the sky, absolutely nothing, to explain what they had just heard. That was what they remembered for years. And then in 1980, my uncle, who remembered the whole incident because they were driving to see my grandparents and my uncle and other family members, he remembered that they lost 2 hours in time they couldn't account for, which They never told me about that. They didn't remember that, but my uncle sure did. And he said, we all thought they were in a car accident because my father knew, you know, how long it would take them to drive, about 8 hours to get there. So shortly after that, when he told me that, he said he started thinking about it because of the movie about Betty and Barney Hill when they were abducted in 1961 on an isolated road in New Hampshire. And he said it sounded just like that. So I contacted Ann Druffel in L.A. She was at the time a MUFON investigator and hypnotist. And I thought, well, if my mom and I were regressed back to that time, maybe we could find out more what happened after the noise, the horrendous noise shaking the car, what happened? Because something happened in 2 hours. And we both said that something happened to us. And I went a little further and felt that we had been abducted by grays. So that was my first experience.
And that was 1950.
Yes, 1950. And that time, there was a lot of UFO reports. Of course, we called them flying saucers back then. But a lot of reports of cars stalling on the roads and UFOs hovering over cars and just a lot of crazy stories.
What did you find out about what happened in 1950? And you were 6 months old, so but you still have memories of it?
Well, they say that our mind, you know, is like a recorder, a tape recorder. And everything that we see and do, even while we're in the womb of our mother, you know, we record. So I believe that, you know, even though I was so young, that I did pick up, I said, I remembered being in the back seat in a basket, not a bassinet, but in a basket when we were traveling. I saw these shadows. I felt that we were taken up right through the top of the car. We went through there like, you know, it was nothing. And we're taken up inboard this huge craft, huge. And I could see my father below in this, it was a clear floor. I could see him down below in another level. He was sitting in this cup-tight chair looking out like he was paralyzed. And my mother was calling out to me, and she was in this tube type. I don't know what it was. It was some kind of clear tube. And I could see that she kept calling to me. She was afraid. And what's interesting about all that is she started having dreams about me being abducted shortly after the trip. So, you know, I don't know if it happened. Something happened. I mean, how can you explain 2 hours gone without any memory of it?
And the thing about missing time is common amongst the abduction kind of thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. People are made erase their memories so they don't recall. And I think there's probably millions of people that have been abducted out there. Maybe they have implants in them. There's just too many stories. And some people just don't want to come forward. They're afraid. They're going to lose their jobs, be ridiculed. You know, the military comes after them. The men in black show up. There's just too many things.
After that encounter when you were 6 months old, have you had others since then?
Yes. Well, I should go to the time I was 3 years old. And this may not be connected, but I think there is a connection. I had two invisible playmates, my mother told me, and I don't remember them, but I described them, and she didn't remember what they looked like to tell me, but I guess they gave me little messages, secret messages that I wouldn't tell my mom, that they'd tell me different things that were going to happen, and I refused to tell her, and that's all I remember. And then when I was in first grade, it was a cloudy day. I remember that. And I'd walk home from school. It was probably about three blocks. And that day, I started walking, And I remember I felt something watching me. You know that feeling when you feel something's watching you and you can't see it, but you just have that feeling. Well, I had that feeling. And I looked up in the sky and I see this huge silver disc up there. And I was petrified. I was so scared. I would go a little ways and hide in some bushes and then walk a little further. And then I'd run. And this is the really weird part. And it may be a screen memory, because a lot of people have screen memories of incidents that didn't happen. But somehow I got across busy street. And I don't even remember if there was traffic, but somehow I got across this busy street and I went to this house and I'm pounding on the door, let me in, let me in. And no one answers. And during that time, people didn't lock their doors. We trusted everybody then. And I went into the house and got under a bed. And I don't know how long I was there. Now, I think that was a screen memory because I don't think that actually happened. I think I was actually abducted. But when I got back, my mom was frantic. She thought she didn't know what happened to me. I told her what happened. We walked around the neighborhood. There was other children that had seen the same thing, and they were scared. So what happened, I don't know. But it was very strange. Then another incident, when I've had a lot of missing time through the years. I won't go into all the missing time stuff, but I was on a little camping trip with a friend of mine. We went up to a hot springs in Idaho, central Idaho, and we'd gone in there during the day to the hot springs, and then we came out. We decided to camp, and we couldn't find a place to camp around there. All the camping spots had been taken. He had a SUV, so we decided we found this little place to pull in. It wasn't really a spot, but we made it a spot, and we put down the back of the, you know, the car on the SUV, and we made up our little beds in our sleeping bags. And I remember looking in the back of the SUV, the Blazer that he had, and there were all these big trees that had fallen. And there was all these bushes back there, and it was like nobody could get through there. But what was really strange, I woke up first. And I couldn't move. I felt like I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. And I heard these voices walking past. And I couldn't make out what they were saying. It was some kind of language I couldn't understand. I mean, it wasn't English. It wasn't Spanish. It wasn't anything I could recognize. And finally, I was able to get up. And I turned around. And I thought I saw form, not running, floating in the back, getting away from us. And it was really eerie. They had no flashlights. There was nothing. So how could they see and run through all this bush, you know, the bushes and the trees? How is that possible? So he woke up. My friend woke up. He was panicked. He felt something alien was there, and I did too. He got in the front seat and we took off. We left that area. So I think there was something that happened that night.
And when you have these missing time experiences, is it just completely seamless? Like you don't even notice that there's been some time taken out?
Yeah, well, I'll give you an example of that. This was in the late 1970s. I was living in Portland, Oregon, and my father lived in Salem, Oregon. And I decided to visit him. It was around 4 o'clock, and I knew it would take about an hour to get there with traffic and everything. There wasn't a lot of traffic, and he expected me around 5 o'clock. Well, I showed up at 6 o'clock, and he said to me, "Where have you been?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Look at the time. Where have you been?" So an hour was missing. I have no idea. I mean, I just remember driving and how I got from, you know, Portland to Salem, you know, is amazing that, you know, I didn't remember something that an hour was missing. I didn't.
Yeah, it's creepy.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's the ETs that are editing your memories, or it's this thing where...
I think so.
Yeah, okay. Because I've heard that our brains automatically cut things out that are really traumatic.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, I've always felt since that time I was, you know, whatever happened when I was 6 or 7 years old in first grade, shortly after that experience, that encounter, I started having lucid dreams. I mean, they were nightmares of geological changes on Earth. And I would be standing on a pier and suddenly I'd see these huge tsunami waves coming in. Of course, it didn't harm me. I would be walking with people trying to get away from volcanoes erupting. The wind, incredible winds, the earth shaking, earthquakes. And this went on for at least a week, every night. And I thought I was shown something that's going to happen in the future. And I think we're seeing a lot of these, you know, amazing things going on now, all these earth changes happening. And I think we're going to see much more. A lot of these things are accelerating.
It's something that you hear about over the years from abductees, isn't it? That sometimes they say the aliens sit them down in front of some sort of a TV and they show them mm-hmm. images of the world dying off.
I know. I know. Isn't that horrible? Help us then. But, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of Nancy Leader. She has Zeta Talk. She says that she's in touch with the Zetas. And she's been predicting that the Earth poles are going to shift and, you know, great cataclysmic things are going to happen. But that she said, like in 2000, that was going to happen, that they told her. I think they lie a lot, but it hasn't happened. We're still here. And not to say it's not going to happen. I mean, a lot of people have predicted these major things, but still nothing.
Yeah, it's that idea that the ETs are like tricksters, aren't they? They're always keeping us guessing.
Yeah, and they lie, I think. They lie a lot about who they are, what they're doing, about the experiments. So many people have been experimented on. I mean, my book is full of people that have been experimented on, and I think one of the major groups that are being abducted are indigenous people, Native Americans, and other indigenous people. And they say that they've been told that something's different about their DNA, and that's why they're being abducted. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's why they seem to land in their reservations. I mean, you know, it's a place where there isn't a lot of people out there, and they can get away with it. Come at night, abduct somebody and do whatever they do, take them to their underground base, undersea base, and do their experiments.
Yeah, because you've got some great stuff in the book from, is it R.D. Six Killer Clark?
Yes.
Could I ask you about something that's in the book, The Benevolent Blue Men, and what happened in Vietnam?
Oh, my gosh. Well, there's a lot of stories, and I wish more people would come forward. There must be other soldiers besides Native Americans, Indians, that experienced the Blue Men that saved them. They're the benevolent Blue Men. And how they've described them is nearly 8 feet tall. They're very muscular, but they're more of a hologram. They are kind of like they're existing in two worlds. They say that they can make themselves solid, but because they've evolved so far that they can actually be more spiritual. And this happened many times in Vietnam. Ira, now all these names that are in the books are, you know, not real names. She used other names because all of these Native Americans don't want people showing up their door and driving them crazy and military after them. But Ira was in Vietnam. He was in the DMZ. And he told her this story. He was living in Hawaii at the time when she went to visit him. She visited people all over the world, actually. And he said that he saw many of his men were being killed, and they were watching this one area where they knew the Viet Cong was located, their encampment. And it was near a hill, and they kept seeing these blue lights flashing, blue all over the place. And they saw a ball that was three times larger than the moon hovering over this area. And what's really strange is Ira said that there was absolutely no sound. There was no crickets. You know, jungles are full of sounds, birds and all kinds of animals. They said it became totally quiet. And then they heard encampment near the encampment where the VC were, gunshots pierced the night. And they thought the VC was firing on the blue reflections. And then suddenly a beam of light shone down on the encampment. And they heard an explosion, and then there was no more. It said that then all of a sudden blue images started going towards the U.S. soldiers. And they said they were human-like men encased in shimmering blue light. Now, they were described as 9 feet tall and muscular, very muscular. And they said, that's the Starmen. But they felt their lives were saved by the blue men, because when they reached the encampment, there was no Viet Cong there. There was the smell of melted hot metal, and jungle rot. But there was no Viet Cong. They said there was three huge circles, they thought, where the aliens had vaporized them. But I guess what these blue men do, they don't kill anybody. They just move them to another area. But he said it was one of the, he felt that his life and some of the men were saved because of it.
We're going to be running out of time soon, but I just wanted to ask you, could you let people know about your podcast? Where is it? Where can they find it?
Oh, okay. It's on Blog Talk Radio, and it's called Stargate Radio. So you just put in Blog Talk Radio Stargate Radio. I was going to have an amazing lady. She's been on my show a couple of times, Marisol Smiley, tomorrow, but she's in Florida, and the hurricane is pressing down on her area. So we canceled it until October. Let's see, we've got her October 3rd on Thursday at 6 o'clock Eastern time. But she has had more ET experiences. She was in, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Berkshire, Massachusetts abduction in 1969, where all these children were abducted. And no, it became a movie. Oh, yeah, there's a movie. Tom Warner. She watched that movie and she went, oh, I know Tom Warner. I was abducted with Tom Warner. And she contacted him on Facebook, and now they're good friends again. But she remembered seeing all these children on board this UFO. And we're going to talk about her abduction. Amazing, amazing story. But she captures these orbs in the sky all the time. What looks like an angel. Just incredible. I posted these photos on Blog Talk Radio on the show platform, so they can go and look at it there. But amazing. Marisol Smiley is her name.
Can you tell us about your other books?
Yes. Oh, lots of them. There's Stargate. There's stargates, there's star beams, there's stargates is about portals that are all over the world that are used by aliens. And even Native American shamans have used these portals to go in and out and travel the universe. Many legends about that. There's Earth energy, aliens, Alaska's deadly mysteries. That's another one.
I suppose people just need to go on Amazon and put in your name and they'll come up.
Right. And they can go to my website, which is BetsyLewis.com. Betsy is B-E-T-S-E-Y, Lewis, L-E-W-I-S.com. I've got most of my major books posted where it says books. Just click on that and they can read my daily blog, which has a lot of alien information, current news, and other things that I post on there. So they can read that. I'm also a psychic. I've predicted many, many things that have come true, major things.
Well, thanks a lot for being on the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you, Simon. Thank you for finding me. I bet you're an ET abductee too, or have you seen UFOs?
Yes, a couple of times. Yeah,
I knew it.
So in this episode, we had two interviews. The first was Adam Frank talking about his book, The Little Book of Aliens. And the second guest was Betsy Lewis talking about her book, Abducted, True Stories of Humans Kidnapped by Aliens. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode, which is over an hour and a half. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and all the links are in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.